Wow, that was a fast year. Yeah, only seven times every 7 years do we get to meet on the very last day of the year. This is December 31st. And next time we will gather again on Sunday will be next year. Well, so we'll see you on the other side. A lot of things have happened. We've had births into the family of Christ. And also we've had people that have passed from us, who are on the other side of the Jordan River, and now they are experiencing the thing we only hope for. Lil Peek passed away, we know, Wednesday. And I don't know if Robert's here, but our condolences go out to the family. But what a warrior she was in many ways for the Lord, and we just rejoice with her because, you know, that's what life on this earth is all about. It's making the most of it so we can get to heaven. And that's what we want to talk about this morning, because the new year is not just a time for celebrating and getting together. It always serves as a time for reflection. And I know it's just another day on the calendar tomorrow. And yet it is appropriate just in your life to find some time somewhere that you look back and say, well, how have I been doing? Where have I been excelling, and where do I need to work even still more? And traditionally, we tend to do that on New Year's Day because it starts a new calendar year. And so the question is then, how do you define success when you look back and say, well, yeah, I had a good successful year? Now, often success is limited in many people's eyes just to things like, well, financial well-being. I had a good year successfully. In fact, when you look at the definitions of the dictionary, it's defined as accomplishing or fulfilling some type of goal or that which you were aiming or your purpose in life. So you look at, well, that was my goal and I got it done. And so Webster's goes on and says it's favorable or desired outcome, the attainment of wealth, favor, that's from others, and preeminence or eminence. In other words, you are powerful. Now, often when we look at someone and at what they have acquired, we say, well, that's a successful person. Now, while that may be true in the financial realm, isn't that view kind of narrow? Because life is much more than just what we obtain, because there's so many other areas. Because we could look at someone and say, boy, they're not very successful when it comes to their health. Or you might look at their family relationships, whether it be their marriage or children, saying, man, they've got a successful marriage. Boy, their family's far from a success. See, when you ask what is successful, we sometimes narrow it in our perspective too narrow, and we don't take a broad enough approach to evaluate our life on this earth. And so we have things, people saying, well, success is being happy. Well, I think that would be a goal that you want to have, but is there more to life than being happy? And maybe what is it that makes you happy? Well, it's doing your best at the opportunities that are given you. It's being able to travel. Well, there's a degree of success in that. Well, it's balancing work with play. Well, I could agree to that, but again, maybe it's being loved by others. That's what Forbes says. You know, you do enough for others that they love you. Well, I can appreciate the sentiment, but something's narcissistic about that too as well. But how do you define success? How do you evaluate yourself and how you're doing on this earth? We talked last week about how we'll all stand before a judge. And we'll have to give an account for how we lived our life on this earth. And we want to live a life well on this earth. We want to live a good life. And we want to hear those words, well done, thou good and faithful servant. So how do you live a life well on this earth? Well, surprisingly, Jesus, unsurprisingly, gives us a way to evaluate your life on this earth. And it's in Luke 12, and I thank Josiah for reading it, but I want you to take a peek at once again, because here we have a parable, and it's called the parable of the rich fool. And it all is prompted by people that are squabbling about an inheritance. And Jesus uses this concern about money as a teaching opportunity. And that's where he begins in verse 15, "Beware and be on your guard against every form of greed. For even when one has an abundance, does his life consist of his possessions?" And that's really profound when you think about it, because often people measure their life in terms of things they have collected. But Jesus says, no, life is much more than that. Life consists of way beyond that. You need to raise your perspective higher. Well, who's going to be able to give us a perspective to know how to evaluate life? Well, thankfully, it's only God. Because God is one that lives above the arch of this physical world. He being our creator and our sustainer, and knowing that all good gifts come from him, even the ability to make wealth. He's able to look down and say, here is how you can know you've had a successful year, a successful life on this earth. And now he goes on and gives this parable of this young rich man. In other words, his life was so successful the past year in which he lived. He had so much harvest, he didn't know what to do with it. And so he had a successful year when it came to farming. Now you understand, in that day in the Middle East, similar to many places in the world today, the success was just having enough food to put on your table that day. And so the epitome of success was not like the Powerball that's $440 million this weekend. The next drawing is January 3rd, and millions of people will be lined up, won't they, to buy their $2 ticket. Because they think, if I could just hit the big one, then life would be secure. Then I'd be happy. Then I could travel. Then I would be successful. Just no. Life consists more than that. Well, please tell us, Lord, what is it? This guy had everything. He had a great year, and yet that great harvest presented a problem. What do I do with it? What would you do with $440 million? He said, I know what to do. I'll just build bigger barns, store what I have, and then just sit back, kick back, eat, drink, and be merry. Because your life is set. You have enough wealth, because wealth was measured in terms of livestock and food and clothing in that day, that you can just take it easy for the rest of your life. And Jesus says, that fool. Because he didn't realize that something was coming, and that was his death. And God said to him, you fool, this very night your soul is required of you. In other words, you're going to die. And so he failed to understand two things. That physical abundance is temporal, and it does not provide any security in the spiritual realm. And then also, when you look at that, that which he spent his life acquiring will be spent and appreciated by someone other than himself. Now, isn't that often the case? You build your life making an abundance, and then when you pass, either the government, the tax man, or your in-laws inherit what you spent your life building. And he says, here's the lesson, the life principle. So is the man who stores up treasure for himself. Now, is he saying it's wrong to have treasures on this earth? But the contrast is when you have treasure on this earth and you're not rich toward God. And it's that statement that I want us to evaluate, that is how you're going to determine true success on this earth. When you are rich toward God. Now, really, our lesson's over right here. If you can figure out what that means, you're going to know how to live a successful life. And some of you are saying, good, let's go eat. But since we have a few moments, let's explore what it means to be rich toward God. Now, we can look at a lot of passages that the Lord has spoken, and God, who lives again in the heavenlies, says, here's how you determine wealth towards God. Here's how you make yourself rich towards him, spiritually wealthy. And we're going to just pick six of them and look at them very briefly. but they describe for us how to judge and evaluate our life lived on this earth. So you want to do that together. Six quick things. The first one we're going to look at is coming to know God. And one of our favorite passages, at least mine, is in Jeremiah chapter 9. Look at it with me, because there's nothing new under the sun. And here in the nation of Israel, they get caught up measuring success by the same type of things, power, a wealth. And Jeremiah has to talk to him and says, well, that's not the way it's supposed to be evaluated. Verse 23 of chapter 9. Thus says Jehovah, let not the wise man glory or boast in his wisdom. That's what makes you successful. Let not the mighty man, that's a man of power and authority, glory or boast in his might. And he adds the third party, and this is almost right out of Webster's dictionary, wealth and power and favor, right? Nor let the rich man glory or boast in his riches. Oh, I'm successful, look at all this wealth. He says, that's not how you measure true success. If you want to boast, verse 24, let him who glory or boast in this, that he understands and knows me. Now, this is not some cerebral abstract concept when we talk about knowing God. In fact, it's the language that is used of Joseph and Mary speaking of sexual relationships between a husband and wife. It's that intimate and personal that you know someone deeply. It's not just some awareness of who they are. But it speaks of someone who's walked with God, who's called on his name, that has chosen to follow him. And so they've lived a life with God, and they've seen God interact in their life and bless them. And they see that when they've stumbled, he's still been there to pick them up. And so they have a relationship, and they know something about him that the rest of the world doesn't. We've mentioned over and over, the U.S. survey shows 70, 80% believe Jesus is the Son of God. They believe in a God himself. But do they know him? Jeremiah is suggesting that's not the case. Even among his religious people, God's the Jews, they didn't know him. Well, what is there to know about God? He says that I am Jehovah. And he exercises three things: loving kindness, judgment, and righteousness in the earth. For in these, it says, I delight. See, if there's something that puts a smile on God's face that he enjoys doing, it's these three things: exercising loving kindness and judgment or justice and righteousness. Let's just take the first one, loving kindness. What does that word mean? It's the Old Testament equivalent to the New Testament word grace. God delights in doing for you what you're not able to do for yourself. When you find yourself in a predicament, you're in over your head and you brought it on yourself and you're crying for help and everyone looks at you, hey, you got yourself into it, get yourself out. God is there when you call upon him. And he delights in redeeming you and saving you. It gives him joy that when they are broken, call to him for help. Now, here's our first clue. Often the people that don't know God, it's because they've never been broken in their lives. They are such an achiever and a self-sustainer, they've never had to look up and call on him because they've been able to trust upon themselves for success on this earth. And perhaps it's only the individual like David or Jonah or Peter. People that have wept bitterly because they've sinned greatly or they found themselves perilously close to death, that they finally looked up to God and cried out for help and then tasted of his deliverance, that they come to know him. And they chose to walk with him from then on. That's a successful life. Did you know he delights in that? And you can count on him. You can trust him. And no matter how bad it gets in 2018, it can't get so bad that God will abandon you. He'll always be there and lift you up. That's a successful life. Because then when blessings come on the earth, I enjoy them. But when they're taken away, it doesn't bother me, because here's the next passage And it's found for us in Matthew chapter 6. Now, Jesus there begins in verse 19. He says, "Do not lay up treasures on the earth, where rust and moth and thieves will come in and steal." See, they're temporal. Now, is he saying it's wrong to have them? No, it's a not but clause. Don't do it here, but primarily make sure you lay up treasures where? Verse 20, lay up for yourselves treasures in heaven. This is a successful life. When you have treasures laid up in the heavenly realm. Now that begs the question, what is it? How do I deposit treasures in heaven? I know how to have a 401k or an IRA or have a savings account. I can put money under my mattress. I know how to lay up treasures on this earth, but how do you lay them up in heaven? Jesus says, if you understand, if you could get high enough and look at the big picture, you would understand the most important thing you could do is lay up wealth in heaven, where it has spiritual purchasing power in the life after, where things of theirs has no value down in heaven. They have some down here, but they're of no value in heaven. Well, how do we do that? How do I lay up treasures? It's interesting. John Ortberg writes this way, and it's quite a quote, but I just always want to notice the next to last line. He's saying, being rich toward God means you make that which is temporary become the servant of that which is eternal. What does that mean? When God blesses you with wealth, when God blesses you with ability. Now, if you talk to John Wooden, you talk to someone that has excelled in athletics, success is using your abilities to the best that you can, taking most of the advantage of the opportunities that come your way, performing to your highest. Now, Jesus would borrow some of that language. Well, actually, it's borrowed from him. He says, you take everything that's been given to you physically, whether it's your ability, your mental intellect, your wealth, your abundance, and you use it as a servant for that which is eternal. That's how you lay up treasures in heaven. So I still don't get it. Well, that leads us to the next statement. Jesus said in Luke chapter 12, in our text, after he talked about the rich fool, he says, sell your possessions, give to charity, and make yourself money belts which do not wear out, an unfailing treasure in heaven. Let's go back to knowing God. Who's there for you when you can't help yourself? Our God. Who's able to deliver you when you're starving and hungry if you just trust in him? Our God. So who does he use to help deliver people that are struggling and in over their heads? Other children. His other children. Other Christians. And so when we do God's work for him by helping others, because he delights in these things. A cup of water, feeding the hungry, clothing the naked, visiting those that are in sick. I'm actually making deposits spiritually in heaven. Now, is it physical money? No, but is it spiritual wealth? Yes. And that's what he's talking about here. And so that's what we ought to do. Now, that takes us to Matthew chapter 20, where Jesus has to address another issue. The world seduces you into telling you what is important from its perspective. And the world's got it all wrong because Satan's the one that's trying to get us to buy into to conform to the world's standards. And so he says, the women of this world, they love titles. They love being honored. They love being served. Now, truly, who would we evaluate as the more successful, the one being served or the one doing the serving? Well, the world says that's an easy one. The one being served is more successful than the one doing the serving. He says, not true. Not true. It's not this way among you. But if you want to be the greatest, isn't this evaluation success? If you want to be the greatest, you be the best servant of all. Because the Son of Man come to serve, not to be served himself. He gave himself as an example. If God came to serve and every knee will bow before him, true success is finding it in yourself to serve others like God served us. Now, it goes back to knowing God. It goes back to being broken. See, a lot of people won't serve others for several reasons. One of them is it's beneath them. It's beneath them because they feel all that about themselves, that they're all that. And to serve others, well, no, I'm somehow superior, and they feel like others live and exist for their purpose. And that person's never been broken. It's only when they're touched how Christ served them and God has served them when they're unworthy that they realize, wow, at least I can do is help others like you helped me. And that introduces a second reason. A lot of times people look at others and say, hey, you got yourself into it. I pity you, but get yourself out of it. And they look at disdain about on others around them because of their lifestyle choices and how they got in over their head. And it's, man, I feel sorry for you, but they actually, it's disdain. Because I wouldn't do that and they don't do that. And so they just let them go on their way with actually mocking them, if not outwardly, internally. Now, when you go back to knowing God, who has let him down? Who has got themselves into trouble? Who's got in over their head by their own choices? Me. All of us. But what did God do? Did he look down with a superior attitude and said, ha, you got yourself into trouble, get yourself out? No. He came to our rescue because he delights in loving kindness. Now he's a just God because he delights in justice. But he had to pay the price for our problems himself. He had to do for us what we couldn't do, and he rescued us. And when you taste of that kindness, it changes you, and you say, you know, I'm going to serve others just like God served me. I'm going to take the inferior role and serve you and make you the superior in my life. And that's how I lay up treasures in heaven. And there's real joy in giving rather than being the one that's given to. And that leads us to the statement of Jesus that I think is so marvelous. In Luke chapter 10, verse 20, it's just a couple chapters from the text, before the text which we're reading. Jesus sends out his disciples and he says, I'm going to give you power to cast out demons and to heal in my name. And they come back and they said, they're just thrilled because he said, Lord, even the demons are subject to us in your name. And then Jesus says, nevertheless, verse 20, do not rejoice in this, that the spirits are subject to you, but rejoice that your names are recorded in heaven. He says, if you want to find real joy, it's you knowing that there's a book and it's called the Book of Life, and it's kept in the heavenlies, and your name is written in it. You say, well, I don't get what's so significant about that. Very few people will be remembered on this earth. And this is why it's so ironic and so sad, because the world tells us what's important, doesn't it? It tells us how to be successful, whether it's fame or excelling in your job or in your relationships or acquiring wealth or whatever. But when it's all said and done, the world will spit you out. They have no plan for you. They have no care for you. And when you're dead and gone, they don't even have the kindness to remember your name. I tried to look up why this street in which our building is located is called Ewald. I looked in the Salem Historical Archives. I did a fair amount of research trying to find out who was this man named Ewald. I found some people that had the first name Ewald, but no one that was connected to Salem or this street. Now, was there a person named Ewald in which this street was named after? Most likely, because it is a first name. And if it was a person, did they have dreams and aspirations like you and I? Were they single or were they married? Did they have families? Did they work every day, 6 days a week, 10 hours a day, and acquire their little nest egg, and now they're dead? They have a street named after them, and we travel it every Sunday, but you don't even know who the person was. That's what the world does for you. Doesn't even have the kindness to remember your name. Philippians chapter 3. Paul talks about a person named Clement whose name is recorded in the book of life. Now, I just think it's fascinating when Scripture takes up this rarefied space called the Bible. There's not much room to write things in there. It's only 66 books, and you could read the whole Bible in next year if you wanted to. So when you take up this real estate and you write things there, it's because the Holy Spirit's trying to make a point. And when it names someone whose name is in the book of life, that's for our attention. We're supposed to stand up like, what? Now, I don't know anything about Clement. Not a thing, except what? Their name is in the book of life. And you can rejoice because that means you have a dwelling place there. You have treasures awaiting you. And Paul says, unsurpassable riches of glory. Because your name is written. You have an inheritance that's guaranteed, reserved, and you're protected by the power of God until you get there. And each of our names are written there as well. When you were baptized into Christ, you can just see God. Isn't that beautiful? And if we stay faithful, he promises not to erase it. See, that's a successful life. That's a life well lived. That's when you've lived it to the fullest and you've accomplished something on this earth. And because of that, we are rich towards God. And then when things come along, I would love to study out the book of Ecclesiastes this year, and I'm going to try to do that because it has so many wonderful lessons. And one of the lessons is Solomon. He had opportunity to test all sorts of things and make himself happy, whether it was pleasure, it was wine, women, and song. Building. He was an architectural builder of power and kingdoms. And the journey was fascinating to him, but when he got to the end and accomplished what he wanted, his goal, he was left feeling empty. And so he comes up with a statement, all is vanity. Vanity, vanity. There's nothing new under the sun. None of it was fulfilling. But then he gives us a few little gems of things that will make your life successful. And he says, if your name is written in the book of life, if you fear God and keep his commandments, then when you do labor on this earth and you get to enjoy your labor, that's a blessing from God. That's a life well lived. So when you work hard and you're honest and you take advantage of the opportunities, you have a balanced life, it includes all that, and you can eat the fruit of your labor, whether it's money or food or travel, whatever, but you're still heavenly focused and not worldly minded, he says that's a gift of God. And so many people can't enjoy what they do have because they're desperately seeking what they don't have. When I get that, married, the new home, the new job, when I finally get to travel or when I finally get to retire, yeah, then your health is gone. But they all say, then I'll be happy, then I'll be successful. And life so quickly passes them by, like this last year, 2017, because we did not choose to enjoy what we do have today. It's a gift of God. And tomorrow that might be gone, and there might be an abundance even more. And I will enjoy what he gives me. But it doesn't matter. I will live for today and enjoy what he's given me. That's a gift. You go out and eat today. And when you thank God, we thank God for our food because we really mean that. Thank you, Lord. Thank you for blessing me. And I'm going to enjoy what you've given me today. Some of us are going to meet tonight at Donna's place because as Christians, we need to get together socially. And I know some of you are getting together in your families, and you're getting together with your own friends, but it's important just to get together because you enjoy the people that are around you that God has put in your life right now and the blessings they can bring you and build relationships. So it's not even at the senior center this year. It's at it's not even a retirement place. It's a clubhouse. being thankful. And here's the last point of evaluation I'll share with you. Because when it's all said and done, what we have to do is what Paul expresses to us in 2 Timothy chapter 4. Here's a guy that came to truly know God. He was caught up very much in himself, highly educated, politically placed among the Jewish people of his day. But Paul became a broken man, didn't he? He had to go away 3 years to Arabia, probably just to reprocess and get his life back together. But Paul was one that tasted of the kindness and the grace of God and his justice and his righteousness, but he knew God. And he spent the rest of his life becoming the greatest of all by being the servant of all. And that servant brought hardships you and I don't even imagine. Being stoned several times, whipped, being shipwrecked once a night in the deep, spending countless nights in jail. And when it's all said and done, he's in prison in Rome for the second time when he writes this letter in verse 6 of 2 Timothy chapter 4. He said, I mean poured out as a drink offering. In other words, just like they poured out wine of a cup, an offering to a god. He said, my blood is going to be poured out as I live a martyr's, or I die a martyr's death in worship to my God. He said, I'm being poured out as a drink offering, and the time of my departure has come. This is the day he's been praying for. This is the day he's been longing for, to go home and be with his Lord, because he's lived a life well on this earth. Well, Paul, what was the key? How did you have a successful life? Here it is. I fought the good fight. I finished the course, and I kept the faith. And in the future, there's laid up for me the crown of righteousness, because he knows his name is written in the book of life, which the Lord, the righteous judge, will award to me on that day, and not only to me, here it is, but to us all who have loved his appearing. Now, I want you to notice those three things that he says. I fought the fight. Brother, life on this earth is a fight, isn't it? Staying faithful, trying to be different from the world and more like Christ, it's a struggle, isn't it? And you know every day it'll be a struggle. And that's a life well lived. That's a successful life when you just continue to fight. When you get knocked down, what do? Get right back up. And so we don't count the failures. We don't look back at the disappointments. We look at the times we got up. And because we called upon the Lord and he helped us stand up again. The second thing he says, I finished the course. See, Paul can say one thing. I finished. I didn't quit. I kept the faith. I love that tortoise and the hare. Remember that story? Why does a tortoise always win that story? Every time you tell it to your kids, turtle still wins. Why? Because he didn't quit. The hare took time out. He quit. And if you don't quit, that's a successful year in 2018. Because I don't know who's going to pass from us this year. But if you keep fighting the fight, you keep running the course, and you never quit, your name's written in the book of life, and you got treasures piled up there for you in heaven, you're going to hear those words finally. Well done, my good and faithful servant. Enter into the joy of thy master. I hope this helps you understand what a successful life is when we look at 2018 ahead of us. If we just simply finish the race before us, we can say, you know, I've lived a life that's rich towards God. See, I don't have the perspective on this earth. I cannot climb a mountain tall enough to see all of life and all the things that are really important. Too often we're just caught up in our own little worlds and it's so narrow-minded. And whatever the issue of the day is, that's life to us. I got to conquer this relationship. I got to conquer this health issue. I got to conquer this financial issue. And if I do, success. I can't get high enough to see the whole picture, the beginning from the end. God does. He says, the only thing you need to do is come to know me, be rich towards me. I'll take care of the rest. That's a life lived successful on this earth. If you're with us, we have a song. It's appropriate. Teach me thy way, O Lord. I don't want to walk like the world anymore. They really don't care about me, do they? But you'll remember my name. So teach me thy way, O Lord. I come to you, and my life is yours to do as you wish with. Shall we stand and sing? And if we can help you, won't you come forward?